This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, English Premier League players and fans pay tribute to Leicester City's owner who was killed in a helicopter crash. And 70-hour working weeks for less than the minimum wage, possibly more than $1 billion owed. We reveal the widespread exploitation of backpackers and temporary migrants.
Australia clearly has a large silent underclass of hundreds of thousands of underpaid migrant workers. The overwhelming majority suffered in silence, even though we found that most knew that they were underpaid.
Prosecutors have charged a man with hate crimes that carry a possible death sentence over the killing of 11 people in a mass shooting at a synagogue in Pittsburgh over the weekend. There's been widespread praise for the police officers who arrested the alleged killer, some of whom were also shot. North America correspondent Stephanie March reports.
As residents of Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh mourn, more details have emerged about the 20 minutes of terror Robert Bowers unleashed on the Tree of Life synagogue yesterday.
7-1, contact, shots fired.
Prosecutors allege he made his way through the building where three congregations were holding services, shooting worshippers from each group. He had with him an AR-15 assault rifle and three Glock handguns.
We've got about 7 out here. Access to the third floor. Next volley of gunfire, we're taking it.
We're treating this as a barricaded gunman. We're gonna work.
In their search for victims, a SWAT team discovered the gunman on the third floor.
7-1, suspect's talking about all these Jews need to die. We're still communicating with them.
He surrendered after a shootout that left the gunman and officers with bullet wounds. FBI Special Agent Bob Jones.
I'd like again to thank Chief Schubert of the Pittsburgh Police for the heroic actions of his officers. Had Bowers made it out of that facility, there is a strong possibility that additional violence would have occurred.
Police have charged Bowers with 29 separate crimes. U.S. Attorney Scott Brady.
There are 11 counts of murdering victims who are exercising their religious beliefs. There are 11 counts of using a firearm to commit murder, and each of these counts is punishable by death.
Police have released the names of the 11 victims. The youngest was 54, the oldest was 97. The dead include two brothers and a husband and wife aged in their 80s. Mayor Bill Peduto has labelled it Pittsburgh's darkest day.
The Jewish community is the backbone. It is part of the fabric of Pittsburgh. And we will be there in all communities to support our friends in the Jewish community.
As is familiar after a mass shooting in the United States, the nation's divisions over gun control are once again in the spotlight. The President, Donald Trump, says armed guards in the synagogue could have prevented the attack. Mayor Peduto, a Democrat, says that's not the answer.
I think the approach that we need to be looking at is how we take the guns, which is the common denominator of every mass shooting in America, out of the hands of those that are looking to express hatred through murder.
Prosecutors say they believe the gunman was acting alone. He's due to appear in court tomorrow. This is Stephanie March in Washington, reporting for AM.
On Tuesday next week, Americans will vote in key midterm elections. The polls have tightened as the date's drawn closer. Amid deep social and political division, the bulk of Donald Trump's base remains strong. Our North America correspondent Zoe Daniel caught up with two of the president's supporters in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
We're in Pittsburgh and we've come to see Mike and Marianne. They're strong Donald Trump supporters, and I first met Mike back before the 2016 election at the Republican National Convention. So, Mike, 2 years into Donald Trump's administration, what's your broad sense of how he's performing?
Results matter, and promises made, promises kept. And he has followed through on everything that I voted for so far. We're only two years into the term. The economy is the best we've had in decades, and the economy is big with me. And so far, I'm 100% behind him. And moving forward, I think he's doing a great job.
Marianne, what's your take?
I agree with Mike. He has kept the promises that he said he would do, and with the tax cuts. I'd like to see a little more on the health care, if they can, do a little more with that. I'd like to see the wall done. He hasn't done that yet, but he's trying. But in the midterms, if we don't get the House, I don't think we're going to get the wall. So, and as Mike said, the economy is doing very well. I think just maybe a little bit of the rhetoric, just to cut it down just a bit. You know, he does such a good job, and, you know, people support him, and then he might say something a little bit that maybe he shouldn't say, just to tone it back just a bit. And I'm not saying he should change how he is, but just tone it back just a bit. And I think what's going to help now, too, is the Kavanaugh effect. I really think that motivated a lot of Republicans, and people saw, right, that they saw that, you know, what was done was wrong. And that really, I think, will help us a little bit more in the midterms.
I think the country is more divided now because of, you know, Trump and all that. And after the Kavanaugh and, you know, what Charles Schumer said and the Democratic leadership said, within 20 minutes after the name went put forward, Schumer and all the Democrats lined up, I'll be damned, you know, hell or high water that Kavanaugh is going to get confirmed. Well, he is confirmed. Get over it. He voted for it.
Is it fair to say that some of that economic growth is to do with groundwork that was laid by the previous administration?
And I'm being honest, no, I don't think so. Because President Obama had said, we're not even going to get to 3, you know, on the GDP. And guess what? Look what it is for. I don't think he tried hard enough. I don't think he couldn't do it. So I don't think what he did laid the groundwork for Trump. Trump did the tax cuts. He did that. There was just a lot of other things that he's done, and he gave jobs to people. So, yeah, that's why I think it's due. And he's done a lot more in 2 years than President Obama had did in the full 8 years.
Do you think that if the Democrats win the House, we'll see a move to impeach the president?
Absolutely. Unfortunately.
Definitely, they will.
I hope not. I mean, we need to win. I think if the Democrats do win the House, there'll be a movement. I mean, the day one. I mean, as soon as they win the House that night, they're gonna start the process. 2020, if the Democrats, the best they can do is nominate Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, potentially Terry McAuliffe, and Pocahontas from Massachusetts. If that's the best they can do, it's going to be President-elect Trump from 2020 to 2024. That I guarantee.
Zoe Daniel with friends and Donald Trump supporters Mike McMullen and Marianne Stearns. In the British city of Leicester, crowds have been gathering to pay tribute to a Thai billionaire who's believed to have been killed in a helicopter crash on the weekend. Although police are yet to release any further details of those on board, the owner of the Leicester City Football Club was almost certainly killed when his helicopter spun out of control and crashed after a match on Saturday evening local time. On a freezing Sunday in the city, fans came out with team scarves, T-shirts and flowers for a man who'd turned their beloved football team's fortunes around. Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley filed this report from Leicester.
At football matches across the UK, there was a minute's silence for a Thai billionaire who'd infiltrated the British League. Vechai Skriwat Annaprabha, the founder of duty-free giant King Power International, is a giant among football lovers in Leicester. He bought the city's football club in 2010 for $70 million, and with 5,000-1 odds against it, the team rose to the top in 2016, winning the Premiership. In Leicester, shocked fans came to pay their respects.
Just devastating. It just feels numb. It's like losing part of your family because they are the Leicester family. They've, you know, got so much, gave us so much to dream about.
They've done so much for, like, the club and the city. We want to commemorate him for that.
Really, he's took us from almost going into administration to winning the Premier League and getting to the quarterfinals of the Champions League. We can't really express our gratitude as much as we wish, really. And I think this is just our way of saying thank you. And
it's common for the club's Thai owner to travel to and from matches via helicopter, with the aircraft taking off from centre pitch, this time, though, crashing in a stadium car park before bursting into flames. Leicester police have asked for the public's patience as investigations continue and have not confirmed who was on board. But it's clear the 61-year-old billionaire was. Other reports also place his daughter there, two pilots and one other passenger, but that has not been confirmed.
Look.
A Thai youth football team visiting Leicester City with funding from Mr. Vechai paid their respects at the memorial site, where an image of a Hindu god and a small statue of Buddha have been placed. The team coach and his players looked visibly shaken. From the young to the old, they gathered to pay their respects at the stadium. This woman has supported the team for more than 30 years.
I'm so sorry for the family. I'll send them my thoughts.
The crash is being investigated by the Air Accident Investigative Branch. This is Samantha Hawley in Leicester reporting for AM.
And you're listening to AM, where it's 11 minutes past 8. A huge silent underclass of migrant workers in Australia are owed $1 billion in unpaid wages. That's the finding from a landmark study into the problem. More than 4,000 workers were involved in the research, and even though most knew they weren't being paid what they were owed, only 1 in 10 tried to recover the money they were supposed to be paid. Sarah Sedgie reports.
A few years ago, Aoife Cullen and her boyfriend picked up jobs in a hotel pub in outback New South Wales. They knew they could extend their visa by doing regional work.
Do you know what? It was an amazing experience to be in the outback, and we just thought it was going to be an opportunity of a lifetime.
But as the weeks rolled by, the experience soured. The 26-year-old Irish national says they worked 90 days in a row without a day off. They got board, meals and $350 a week for working at least 70 hours.
We worked in the bar constantly every day. We were up from 7:30, 8 o'clock. Then it kind of was like, you know, it got to evening time, the locals would come in and you'd be serving alcohol. You could be standing there from 6 o'clock in the evening to maybe 2-3 in the morning.
A senior law lecturer at UTS, Laurie Berg, says migrant worker exploitation is rife.
Well, we surveyed almost 4,500 international students, backpackers and other migrant workers and found that most of them are earning well below the minimum wage. So Australia clearly has a large silent underclass of hundreds of thousands of underpaid migrant workers.
Almost a third of those surveyed by UTS and UNSW were earning $12 an hour or less, when the minimum hourly rate at that time was around $18. Laurie Berg says few seek any redress.
Among our participants, fewer than 1 in 10 who were underpaid took any action to get their wages they were owed. So the overwhelming majority suffered in silence, even though we found that most knew that they were underpaid. So it seems like stories of exploitation in the media are really the tip of a massive iceberg.
The researchers found that of the few who do try to get back money, more than half recover nothing. Laurie Berg says the Fair Work Ombudsman is ill-equipped to help migrant workers.
Among the more than 2,000 underpaid participants in our survey, only 3% contacted the Fair Work Ombudsman, and well over half of them got nothing. So you can understand that from a migrant worker's perspective, it's just not worth the significant time and effort and face the risk of trying to recover their wages through the Ombudsman as it's currently set up.
Aoife has tried and failed to recover wages via the Ombudsman, and she says the improper documentation of her wages meant her visa application was rejected.
It sounds silly, but it's just a dream. You don't understand. When you live in the UK and Ireland, Australia is just a completely different ballgame and it's so much to offer. It's just one of them things that, like, honestly, I will never get over in my life.
The government's awaiting the recommendations of its migrant worker task force, which are due next month. In the meantime, it says it has strengthened measures to protect migrant workers and boosted the Ombudsman's powers and funding.
That report by Sarah Sedgie and Lexi Metherall. Global markets are set for another rough week as investors confront the reality of a steep correction that could roll out in the coming weeks and months. The ABC senior business correspondent Peter Ryan watched the sell-off last week and he joins me now. Peter, there are some toxic factors behind these falls, but you reckon none of them should come as a shock. Why is that?
Well, Sabra, the big one is what's happening in the United States with interest rates. And you'll recall Donald Trump has claimed a lot of credit for the economic boom there, stoked by massive infrastructure spending and his tax cuts. The US economy is now running at 3.5%, having fallen back from 4.2%. The jobless rate is quite low and inflation is starting to edge up. So the Federal Reserve is gently moving rates higher, which means cheap and easy money is starting to evaporate 10 years after the global financial crisis. Donald Trump doesn't like that. And a few weeks ago, when markets started correcting, he said the Fed was crazy to raise rates. And at the same time, there's also simmering trade tensions between the US and China, which could easily morph into a fully blown trade war. But Paul Gruenwald, a chief economist at S&P Global Ratings, told me that more than that, Donald Trump is also trying to disrupt the way China does business around the world.
Our view is that it's not really about trade. We're not quite done with the trade part of the dispute. We're expecting one more round of tariffs from the U.S. on Chinese toys and electronics, which have been conveniently omitted so far. But we really think in 2019, this will morph into a much broader discussion about the way China does business with the rest of the world.
And is that really the hub of Donald Trump's concerns about China, given the growth of China, the reach of China, and where the U.S. is heading?
That is our reading, that trade pressure is just an entree into this larger discussion. IP, intellectual property, level investment playing field, China playing by the rules. We hopefully will get some clarity at the G20 next month when President Xi meets with President Trump.
We're already seeing a lot of volatility on global markets because of the trade tensions. Investors are nervous about the trade friction. And on top of that, economic growth in China is beginning to slow. Do you see this as a toxic combination potentially?
We think growth is slowing, but I think some of the commentary around China being brought to its knees or that sort of thing is a bit overblown. They were slowing due to deleveraging, which started back in 2016. I would argue that there's been some additional slowdown because of trade tensions, but we still see Chinese growth at around 6% right now.
As you mentioned, there are concerns about very high debt levels in China. Does that remain a potential flashpoint?
Yeah, that remains one of our top risks globally through our credit conditions surveillance. China went from being a low-debt country before the financial crisis to being a high-debt country. So the authorities knew they had to get going on deleveraging. That started again in 2016, but progress has been very incremental and it's paused right now. So there's more work to be done there.
And just back on the United States, the economy is running pretty strongly. Inflation is slowly rising. So the US Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates and is on track for more rate rises. But what do you make of Donald Trump's intervention saying that the Fed has been crazy, even though those rate rises have been gentle?
Trump's language is a bit more strident, if we could put it that way. I do think we're going to see some tension next year, because in our view, the potential growth rate for the U.S. is a bit less than 2. So we're going to have to see U.S. growth go from 4 to 3 to 2 by early 2020. And I imagine the president may not be totally happy about that, because the Fed will be raising rates gradually to try to engineer a soft landing. That will be on investors' minds for the next year or two.
And that's Paul Gruenwald, the chief economist at S&P Global Ratings. He was speaking there with Peter Ryan, who's still with us. Peter, it looks like a pretty hectic week ahead. What are investors keeping an eye on?
Well, some very important full-year results from the banks this week, Sabra. The ANZ reports on Wednesday and the National Australia Bank on Thursday. The numbers, of course, are always important, but we'll be watching for what ANZ's Shayne Elliott and the NAB's Andrew Thorburn have to say about the financial and reputational damage from the Banking Royal Commission, which resumes next month. Analysts are tipping softer profits from the major banks as fallout from the Royal Commission and slower credit growth continue to take a toll.
The ABC senior business correspondent Peter Ryan. You might remember our story last week on just how debilitating mould growth in homes can be. A parliamentary committee has called for more research into the potential health impacts of the unwanted fungal growth in properties, but it's also questioned whether enough is being done to prevent it, particularly in rental properties. With more, here's political reporter Alexandra Beach.
Kayla Brudd runs a Facebook support group for those who say mould has made them extremely ill. For most, the problem begins at home.
It kind of starts in the building. If the buildings were not damp and water damaged, no one would actually have this condition.
That's why a parliamentary inquiry report has called for the government to work with the states and territories to ensure tenants know about mould or water damage at a property before they move in. It also calls on the government to look into whether Australia's building codes are good enough and to have a closer look at the varied and sometimes unreliable ways people test for mould.
It's a bit of a wild west at the moment in that space. There's an international standard, but a lot of people can call themselves a remediator without really much training.
The committee investigating heard tenants find it hard to get landlords to take the problem seriously. Leo Patterson-Ross from the National Association of Tenant Organisations says there's often an assumption it's the resident's fault.
A landlord or agent's first reaction to you reporting mould is to say, well, clearly you haven't been ventilating enough, you haven't been cleaning enough.
The rules vary slightly in different states and territories, but generally a tenant must keep a property clean and avoid damage, and a landlord must ensure the place is in decent condition at the beginning of a lease and keep it in a reasonable state of repair.
For instance, a bathroom, you can't expect a tenant to be able to ventilate that just by opening a window.
If there's a problem, the matter can go to a tribunal.
But they can't actually force a landlord or an agent to call a tradie or to pick up a hammer and do any work themselves. So if the landlord or agent ignores that order, you have to start going back for compensation.
But not many people find the idea of a prolonged legal battle over mould appealing, and the committee heard tenants who make a fuss are often just evicted. Tim McKibben from the Real Estate Institute of New South Wales says property agents usually want to cooperate, but tenants should also use common sense.
If there is an exhaust fan in the bathroom, use it. If you are able to leave a window open, most bathrooms will have some sort of a window available to them to let fresh air in.
While there are testing methods to pick up signs of water damage, like bacteria in the air, Mr. McKibben says that could just as easily come from a full garbage bin as mould on the wall. And he stresses there's still no evidence it will make you sick.
Where is the science? Where is the science in this? And there just isn't any at this stage.
But with a growing number of people saying mould's behind illnesses that have left them bedridden, the committee's called for more research into its potential health effects.
Provide us with the science, provide us with some guidance as property managers how we can deal with this issue.
The federal government is now considering the report's recommendations.
Alexandra Beach reporting. The Invictus Games have wrapped up with a moving closing ceremony in Sydney over the weekend. There's been widespread praise for the event, which was founded by Prince Harry. The Games are acclaimed as a way to unite veterans and their families. They also promise to deliver a broad range of health and psychological benefits. Catherine Gregory prepared this report.
After a week of sporting events, the Invictus Games held a moving closing ceremony.
You have been incredibly well supported by the public over the last week. Please take that as strong evidence that your community supports you, acknowledges your service.
New South Wales Governor David Hurley summed up how many feel about the event. Australian military veteran John Bale is a big supporter of the Games. The CEO of support group Soldier On now wants the good intentions to turn into action.
The Invictus Games are funded heavily by the Australian government, and making sure that the government follows through with other programs that we're proposing for employment and education. So it's about making sure that the conversations that are started during Invictus are absolutely followed through to set ourselves up for the next generation of veterans.
Part of that, he says, is more support for veteran employment programs and resourcing to the veteran charity sector. John Bale points out research has been done into how the Invictus Games do help participating veterans. One of those is the Invictus Pathway program run by the University of South Australia, which tracks veterans' physical and mental fitness as they train and also after the event. Dr. Katia Ferrer, who leads the project, says she's not aware of any research looking into the Games' impact on the veteran or wider communities.
We probably have to look to perhaps sort of the social marketing evidence that we have from the Toronto Games. Research did show that the Canadians, there was a fundamental shift in their sort of view and support of servicemen and women and veterans, and also even a willingness to support veterans in the community more.
The Games will cost about $30 million, and the federal government invested around around 8 million of that. There's also money from the states. So what sort of return does this generate for Australian veterans going forward? Invictus Games CEO Patrick Kidd says it's hard to show a dollar value.
All of a sudden you're now seeing organisations talk to each other that traditionally haven't talked to each other. And it's that collaboration that really will be one of the lasting legacies that come from the Games. But I do think that, you know, there's a challenge here when we complete the Games, they themselves continue to maintain the momentum.
Veterans Affairs Minister Darren Chester agrees the Games need a strong legacy. He points to a recently announced initiative, Veterans Sport Australia, which connects sporting organisations and veterans to continue this momentum in adaptive sports.
So in terms of actual outcomes from the Games, I think that's important.
Has there been any sort of monetary commitment from the money that might have been made from the Games?
The Invictus organisation, the money that they use to put on the Games is then invested in having future Games. But in terms of the money we provide here in Australia for our veterans, the $11.2 billion, it's about making sure that those veterans who need help can get help when they need it. We've got to get better, I think, at making sure the services are delivered in a very timely way.
The Federal Veterans Affairs Minister Darren Chester ending that report by Catherine Gregory. An unlikely advocate is helping to lead the campaign to save Anglican churches in Tasmania from being sold to help fund the Child Sex Abuse Redress Scheme. John Temple is one of the many survivors of church sex abuse, but he's determined that his local church, St Mary's, won't be sold to help foot the bill. He's part of a small community that's raising money to save its churches, and he's also offering support to survivors with a specially written apology song. Felicity Ogilvie reports from Hagley in northern Tasmania.
Harper's Joanne Mitchelson has written this hymn to acknowledge the pain and suffering of the children who are abused by clergy.
After the concert, I found that a really important line in my song is apparently that I pointed out that a lot of little children sought for help and tried to tell people that something bad was happening to them, but they were told to basically shut up and not to tell a lie.
Listening in is John Temple, a man who was abused at church schools in Victoria.
I had one bad experience at age about 8. From then on, I was aware and I was in hiding at school.
The redress payments will help him afford retirement, but he doesn't want that to come at the cost of selling off the local church here at Hagley.
I believe if asked, people could come up with the money. And there's, you know, I'm thrilled at the support the notion of redress has in the community. And I'm sure lots of people would support that and the churches wouldn't have to be sold.
The Anglican Church in Tasmania needs $8 million to pay redress to survivors of child sex abuse. But it will raise far more money than that by selling off up to 76 churches. The rest of the millions will be spent on what the Bishop Richard Conde calls new ministries, but he didn't want to be interviewed by AM.
The concern is that the Bishop has a new form of ministry that he is advocating, and that doesn't require this sort of church.
About half of the churches that are slated for sale, including this one at Hagley, are trying to raise the money needed to pay child sex abuse debts and fund new ministry. But it will be December before the locals find out if their local fundraising will save their churches. It's a stressful wait for the church warden at St Mary's, Rosemary Stobart.
I got married here, my children were baptised here, confirmed here, one of my children were married here. So it does have a very big feeling for me. It's a lovely church, yes.
The state government is busy writing new laws to protect the graves that surround most of the Anglican churches that could soon be sold. But here at Hagley, the remains of the former Premier of Tasmania, Sir Richard Dry, are more closely tied up with the church. And the thought of this place being sold horrifies John Temple.
Sir Richard is buried in the church. It was part of the graveyard, but then the church was extended, so he's actually now in the church underneath the altar.
And how will that work if this church is sold under the redress scheme in terms of rights for relatives visiting a grave when it's inside the church?
Very interesting. Is someone going to put their kitchen sink over the top of it?
That's abuse survivor John Temple ending that report from Felicity Ogilvie in finance. Economists will be watching the latest official inflation data out on Wednesday. The CPI is expected to come in softer at 1.9% over the year. Oil is higher this morning. It's trading at $67.53 US a barrel. And the Australian dollar is weaker. It's trading at 70.9 US cents. That is AM for today. I'm Sabra Lane. It is 8:30.